Hi, I'm Doug Phillips from Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital, speaking to you from New York. This is the March broadcast of the American Journal of Neuroradiology podcast. We'll be covering some choices for the March issue of the American Journal of Neuroradiology, breaking them down into the editor's choices and fellow's choices of interest. Among the editor's choices, the first paper is by Hussein et al. Title: Occurrence and Predictors of Futile Recanalization Following Endovascular Treatment Among Patients with Acute Ischemic Stroke, a Multicenter Study. Despite the fact that arterial recanalization is the principal goal of endovascular treatment in acute stroke patients, many of these patients who are so treated fail to get clinically better. The obvious question is why? This is the question addressed by these investigators who have analyzed existing literature on this very important topic. Patients received pharmacological and/or mechanical thrombectomies. The authors tried to establish the cause of poor clinical outcome despite what in most cases was a complete angiographic recanalization. Nearly one-third of the patients underwent IA thrombolysis and recanalization, and the results were fruitless in one-half of them. Factors associated with futile recanalization were older age, involvement of the basilar artery, higher median NIH stroke scale scores, and intracranial hemorrhage. Of these variables, the ones that were statistically significant were older age and lower initial NIH stroke score scale. These were patients with severe neurologic symptoms at the outset. This topic is of considerable importance in institutions that are now gearing up for acute stroke intervention and utilizing intra-arterial thrombolysis or thrombectomies to recanalize thrombosed arteries.
Hi, I'm Doug Phillips, speaking this evening with Dr. Jacques Dionne. Jacques is professor of radiology and neurosurgery and the director of the section of interventional neuroradiology at Emory. Good evening, Jacques, and thanks for joining us. A lot of articles have come across the pages of the American Journal of Neuroradiology lately on aneurysms, and what we're seeing now, I guess as we all kind of expected, knowing that the studies were out there and in progress, are some more long-term follow-up studies on these. You've had a chance to look at a lot of these, I'm sure, and you've talked about a lot of them. Just relate for our listeners, if you will, your feeling about these long-term results as they're being published right now. Do you think they are equaling what you expected to see from endovascular therapy? Are they better than your expectations, or are they less than what you had expected?
Actually, they are either equal or slightly better than what I was expecting. And let me explain that. The one paper or series of paper in particular, I think, that is the most impressive to me is the ISAT study, which was an international study of acutely ruptured aneurysms, and it randomized a patient who could equally be clipped or coiled to clipping or coiling. And as you know, that study was stopped precociously, prematurely, before the accruing of the entire 2,500 patients at around 2,143, I think, because the cohort of coiled patients was doing substantially better, statistically better, than the clipped patients. And that's old news. But what's really interesting about this is I think that the critics of the study have decried a number of things. But the most important, I think, facet of that study is that they have continued to follow those patients. And there have been a number of follow-up papers since then that show that even out at 10 years, there's continued benefit in terms of clinical outcomes for those ruptured aneurysm patients who were treated with coiling compared to clipping. Again, any randomized study comes with potential problems, and the problems with this study were that it was a study mostly of anterior circulation aneurysms and mostly of rather small aneurysms, because there had to be a difference in the perception of whether these aneurysms could be treated by clipping or coiling. But the fact remains that the benefit of coiling in terms of clinical outcome remains and persists beyond 10 years. And it tells me that we're doing what is important, and that is we're allowing patients to have better outcomes. The other papers that you have alluded to in terms of long-term follow-up and so on and so forth, I think pertain more to the physical characteristics of follow-up on aneurysms. And they point out what we've known all along, which is the aneurysms that are treated by endovascular coiling have a higher tendency to recur and sometimes require retreatment compared to surgical clipping. And there is unfortunately no good study yet showing long-term outcomes of unruptured aneurysms that are treated with coiling compared to clipping. And I think that's going to be one domain where it's going to be very difficult to prove a large difference, especially when you throw in the very relatively benign natural history of unruptured aneurysms. On top of that, if you throw in the results of the ISUIA study, which claims that unruptured asymptomatic aneurysms that are less than 7 millimeters in diameter have a fraction of 1% chance of bleeding per year, then studies like this become almost impossible to perform. The TEAM study, for instance, that was championed by the Montreal group, was funded for a short while, and they were unable to continue to accrue patients and to get funding from the Canadian government. That's a long answer to your question, but I think we're doing extremely well. I think we're showing that the retreatment rates are quite low. We're showing the rebleed rates in particular, or the de novo bleed rates for patients who have unruptured aneurysms that get treated by coiling are also extremely low. As you know, the technique has continued to expand throughout the country and is performed in every single major medical center in the United States and in Canada. The other, I guess, point that's important about the ISAT study that we mentioned is that those patients were all treated in the 90s, where our technology was quite primitive compared to now. And despite that, we have the clinical outcome results that we mentioned that continue to surpass those of surgical clipping in the setting of acutely ruptured aneurysms.
So in your opinion now, would you say that we are at a point in history where we can fairly confidently state that endovascular therapy is now the treatment of choice, essentially, for most intracranial aneurysms?
I think it's come to a point where you can present that honestly to a patient as a very efficient treatment that has a low risk. And as I do in my clinic all the time, I always tell my patients that there is one downside, and that it's unquestionable that the price to pay for a minimally invasive treatment is going to be a risk of recurrence that is higher than with surgery, that requires either angiographic or cross-sectional MRA-type follow-up for a few years after their treatment. And we also know that despite the advances in technology that we have today, right out of the box, there's probably going to be 10 to 15% of aneurysms that are just plainly not amenable to at least present endovascular techniques. Aneurysms that have extremely wide necks that either cannot be treated mechanically or that we know have extremely high recurrence rates with endovascular therapy. Large and giant aneurysms, which I think are the Achilles heel of endovascular therapy. And aneurysms that have branches arising from the sac that are very difficult to deal with, if not impossible.
So you go into an endovascular case with the information you have obtained from CTA or MRA, occasionally from the diagnostic angiogram. You treat the patient and you see the patient's outcome. In the cases where the outcome was recurrence of the aneurysm or some other untoward outcome for endovascular therapy, in looking back retrospectively, is there something that you could have known preemptively prior to the treatment that you think could have avoided the recurrence or the complications?
No, there's a few things that we've discovered over the years that increase the chance of recurrence of an aneurysm. And we know that people who smoke have increased chance for recurrence. We know that if you compare a endovascular coiling treatment of unruptured aneurysms to that of patients with a ruptured aneurysm, there is more recurrences seen in the ruptured group as well. But beyond that, there's not much that we know. I think biological science and analysis of aneurysm is sort of aneurysm natural history is slowly going to the perception that there may be potentially some inflammatory process or biological markers that could predict at a certain likelihood that a patient harboring an aneurysm may be at a greater risk of rupture than another, or a patient harboring an aneurysm has entered a biological phase where his or her aneurysm may be more likely to rupture. And I sure hope that we're going to get to a point where we get this kind of biological information about patients is going to help, and I think, in counseling. But in terms of prediction of recurrences at this point, it's very difficult to know.
For the diagnostic neuroradiologists listening, many of course routinely performing and interpreting CTA or MRA on patients with aneurysms. From their point of view, reporting the examinations, what are the points that you find to be the most critical to see in the report? What are the things that you would recommend that everyone performing and interpreting CTA or MRA make sure that they have commented on in diagnosis of an aneurysm in a patient?
Well, I think in the case of unruptured aneurysms, you want to ensure that there are one or multiple aneurysms. I think observing that branch or branches come off of the base or the neck of an aneurysm is very important. I think the observation of what we call the dome-to-neck ratio is another factor that is important to endovascular therapists. That being said, I think we also need to be careful and not knowledgeable that CTA, not in all institutions, but I think in average to even good institutions, there's a tendency for CTA to overestimate the width of the neck of an aneurysm, because there's some partial volume averaging phenomena that occur at the neck of an aneurysm. So that's important. In terms of describing an aneurysm that may be treated by neurosurgical clipping, certainly all the factors that we've talked about to date are important, but calcium. Calcium at the neck of an aneurysm is a big red flag for neurosurgeons. That makes an aneurysm difficult to clip, tends to collapse the parent artery when the surgeon attempts to place a clip. Similarly, there are certain features, in particular basilar tip aneurysms, that surgeons like to know or see described. Otherwise, they just look at it themselves. And that is the height of the neck of the basilar tip and of the neck of the aneurysm in relationship to the posterior clinoid. Those are anatomical factors that impact the neurosurgical approach.
For your patients who have been treated by endovascular route, what is your preferred method of follow-up for those patients long-term?
If I had a wish, my preferred method of follow-up would be MRA. I think MRA recipes to follow-up coiling vary from institution to institution. There are certainly many institutions in this country, in Canada, and in Europe that have found ways that have been actually published to protocol MR follow-up of coiled aneurysms that are quoted to be as sensitive as follow-up angiography. In my institution, we're not quite there yet, so that we're just about there. For the last 10 years or so, what I do in my place is a 6-month catheter angiogram. And if that looks good without evidence of recurrence, then I'll do another 24-month follow-up angiogram. And if that looks good, then I'll commit my patient to follow-up with MRA. And I will do that actually for life. Reason for that is, first reason is we actually need to have long-term imaging data on coiling. Surgeons are still not comfortable with the recurrences that we have. Second, and more importantly, it's been shown in the ISAT study and by others, but in particular in the ISAT study, that patients who form an aneurysm are at more risk for forming de novo aneurysms during the rest of the course of their life. So when I explain this to my patients, I tell them, look, you know, if it's a female, you know, look, you have your mammogram every year. I'm asking you to have a cerebral MRA every year for the rest of your life, one, to follow up your aneurysm, and second, make sure that you're not developing other de novo aneurysms.
That makes perfect sense. Last question, something I'm sure you've thought about, if not have been involved in. There are certainly some developing technologies in additional contribution to endovascular therapy. Are there any of these developing technologies that you see as something particularly promising, something that will further endovascular therapy, perhaps lessen the recurrence rate, make the entire procedure more risk-free? I'm sure you can come at it from a lot of angles. What do you see that excites you now?
Well, actually, if you try to be global, I think there is one, not necessarily technology, but one concept that has been emerging for a number of years that actually was pioneered by Chuck Kerber at first, who was analyzing flow patterns into aneurysms. And that's sort of a mysterious process where we can image flow patterns. We don't necessarily understand what they really mean. We can analyze shear stresses, strike zones, and so on and so forth. And so there's a whole segment of the industry right now that has started to produce devices that are flow diverters. These can be stents of variable mesh densities. There are eccentric covered stents. There's all kinds of devices that are coming out right now that aim at treating the genesis of the aneurysm, which is the weak spot in the wall. the ballooning out, which is the aneurysm, is simply an expression of a wall problem. So these devices aim at trying to restore anatomy by dealing with the paired artery and changing the forces that act at the neck of the aneurysm and the flow that act at the neck of the aneurysm by causing stasis. And there's many devices that have been shown to be successful in closing aneurysms, thrombosing aneurysms, without dealing with the sac itself. The problem at this point with these, I think we know that disturbing flow at the neck of an aneurysm, we can produce thrombosis. That's unequivocal. What is less unequivocal or more equivocal is that we don't quite understand completely what kind of flow disruption is beneficial and what kind of flow disruption can be non-beneficial. There are a few reports now in particular with pipeline device or pipeline-like devices in Europe where aneurysms have not thrombosed after treatment, but rather has actually ruptured. So that is a bad flow modification. The other problem with these devices, at least as of now, as we speak, is that they are paired artery implants that tend to be metallic and require a few months of Plavix and aspirin therapy. So that essentially makes these devices close to impossible or very risky to use in the setting of subarachnoid hemorrhage where patients require ventriculostomies, DP shunts, line placements that are all sort of prone to hemorrhage in the face of a patient who is on aggressive antiplatelet therapy. But I think the whole concept of this flow disruption, I think, is attacking what is the bane of interventional neuroradiology and aneurysm treatment right now, and that is our extremely high recurrence rate and inability to treat large and giant aneurysms. So hopefully we'll be able to tackle that segment of our aneurysm population that has remained, I think, problematic for endovascular therapy.
Doc, I'd like to thank you very much for taking some time and talking with the readers today. Very much appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
The next paper among the editor's choices by Ferns et al., the title, Late Adverse Events in Coiled Ruptured Aneurysms with Incomplete Occlusion at 6-Month Angiographic Follow-Up. Again, we're seeing a large number of papers in the literature on the long-term follow-up in coiling endovascular treatment of intracranial aneurysms. The known late complications of aneurysm coil embolization include rehemorrhage, complications of the diagnostic or therapeutic angiography, and potentially progressive mass effect from aneurysm growth. The authors retrospectively looked at over 900 coiled aneurysms at their 6-month follow-up. Of these, 124 were incompletely occluded and 71% were retreated. This team did over 300 diagnostic follow-up angiograms without complications. As we have previously discussed on podcasts and previous literature, a dedicated angiographic and interventional team can perform these studies with a very low incidence. Performing them without complications is a fairly impressive task. 4 of their aneurysms rebled, of which 2 patients died, and 4 aneurysms regrew, and 1 of those patients died, giving the complication annual rates as follows. The overall event complication rate, 1.9%. Mortality, 0.7%, and rebleeding, 1%. They concluded that angiographic follow-up and recoiling can be done with little harm to the patient, and the complications were only related to rebleeding and aneurysm regrowth. The next paper among the editor's choices is by Co. et al. This is a very interesting paper entitled Non-Enhancing Intramedullary Astrocytomas and Other MR Imaging Features, a retrospective study and systematic review. This is a paper that, to some extent, shakes a lot of people's foundations. Most of us have been taught that by the time of their initial discovery, all intramedullary spinal tumors show contrast enhancement, regardless of tumor grade. The authors did a retrospective review of non-enhancing spinal cord tumors obtained from 4 different institutions. They found 19 patients with cord astrocytomas and analyzed their patterns of contrast enhancement. They found 6 astrocytomas and 2 anaplastic astrocytomas that did not enhance. All of the other tumors did demonstrate contrast enhancement. Then they analyzed the literature, and from it they concluded that 18% of intramedullary primary tumors do not enhance. Thus, non-enhancing astrocytomas, representing somewhere between 20 and 30% of lesions, are not rare and should be included in the differential diagnosis of expansile non-enhancing cord masses. This is not the experience of many of the editors, and certainly not my own personal experience, and the findings have surprised me. The next paper, the editor's choice by Franken et al., Diffusely Abnormal White Matter in Progressive Multiple Sclerosis, In Vivo Quantitative MR Imaging Characterization and Comparison Between Disease Types. We all know that histopathologically, white matter in MS patients is diffusely diseased. Can this diffuse involvement be measured using a quantitative MR technique? And if so, which technique proves to be better suited for that purpose? In this study, the authors used four different techniques: T1 maps, magnetization transfer ratios, ADC, and fractional anisotropy, to assess diffuse white matter changes and attempted to correlate their results with the type of MS the patient had. They found that all four techniques showed abnormal results in the white matter of MS patients. Furthermore, they found that these measurements differ for patients with primary progressive and secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. The next series of papers from AJNR, March issue, are the fellows' choices of interest. The first paper by Kang et al., Diffusion MR Imaging of Hypoglycemic Encephalopathy. Brain imaging findings in adult hypoglycemia have not been well established, and here the authors have retrospectively reviewed the MR features in 11 such patients. The areas found to be most severely affected on conventional MR imaging and DWI with ADC maps were the posterior limbs of the internal capsules, the hippocampi, and the basal ganglia. In these regions, ADC values were about 50% of normal. In 6 patients, the imaging findings resolved. Those patients did well. Patients with cortical or diffuse white matter involvement affecting more than one lobe did poorly or died. The lesions that resolved did so very quickly and were probably related to reversible cytotoxic edema. The next paper among the fellows' choices by Meckel et al., Cerebral Venous Thrombosis, Diagnostic Accuracy of Combined Dynamic and Static Contrast-Enhanced 4D MR Venography. Cerebral venous thrombosis has been widely discussed in the literature in the recent past. It is very likely a common disease. What are the best techniques to assess it? The optimal MR techniques to assess cerebral venous thrombosis is at least somewhat uncertain. Here the authors looked at 39 patients who underwent brain imaging using 4D MRV, 2D time-of-flight MRV, gradient echo imaging, and routine T2-weighted sequences. In the evaluation of the thrombosed venous sinus, 4D MRV performed the best. For cortical vein thrombosis, the best sequences were 4D MRV and time-of-flight MRV. The same was true for patients with chronic sinus thrombosis. However, for isolated cortical vein thrombosis, gradient recalled echo images performed the best. Overall, all MR modalities did well, with specificities ranging from 96 to 99%, and that's pretty phenomenal performance. This article contains supplemental movies found online only. Those of you who routinely visit AJNR online can take some time and review those 4D MRV images. The next paper among the fellows' choices, Bizdas et al., Perfusion CT in Squamous Cell Carcinoma of the Upper Aerodigestive Tract, Long-Term Predictive Values of Baseline Perfusion CT Measurements. Last month, we covered a number of papers on perfusion CT in head and neck cancer. This paper adds to that body of literature. In this paper, the authors sought to find a relationship between perfusion CT results in patients with squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck and survival rates. 84 patients treated with chemoradiation were assessed with maps of blood flow, blood volume, mean transit time, and permeability. Blood volume and permeability were higher in those patients with longer control periods, and both parameters were predictive of local tumor control. Thus, higher blood flow and permeability and a mismatch between blood volume and blood flow predict a good outcome. If you will, please refresh your memory, listen to the February podcast for more information regarding this subject. The final paper among the fellow's choices for this month, Sirlan Popovic et al., Changes in Perfusion CT of Advanced Squamous Cell Carcinomas of the Head and Neck Treated During the Course of Concomitant Chemo Radiotherapy. This article is from the same group of investigators as the previous article. In this paper, the authors have evaluated similar parameters, but in a group of 20 patients who had locally advanced head and neck squamous cell carcinoma and who were treated with chemo radiation. As would be expected, the tumor volumes were reduced regardless of radiation dose in responders. In responders, significant reductions in blood volumes were seen, while changes in all other parameters were not significant. It seems that in this group of patients, blood volume maps were a better predictor than blood flow and MTT. This is a somewhat different outcome than on the previous study with more local tumors. Thus, CT perfusion results as they relate to prognosis may be different for advanced tumors when compared to more localized disease. There's obviously a lot of information yet to be gleaned from our experience with CT perfusion in head and neck cancer, both for primary disease and for nodal disease. That's the end of our papers for this month for the American Journal of Neuroradiology. Thank you, and we'll talk to you again next month.